Welcome. I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Peggy Orenstein, is a breast cancer survivor. Or at least she thought she was in the clear after a mammogram in 1996 detected a small tumor and she had it removed. She considered herself, quote, a loud and proud example of the benefits of early detection. But 17 years later, Peggy's cancer returned. And now in her recent essay, Our Feel-Good War on Breast Cancer, published in the New York Times Magazine, Peggy asks, how much had my mammogram really mattered? She reports that mammography's impact is decidedly mixed. It does reduce by a small percentage the number of women who are told they have late-stage cancer, but it's far more likely to result in overdiagnosis and unnecessary treatment. And yet, she says, mammography remains an unquestioned pillar of the Pink Ribbon Awareness Movement. And as for the Pink Ribbon Awareness Movement, Peggy Orenstein critiques that, too. She says, just about everywhere I go, the supermarket, the dry cleaner, the gym, the gas pump, the movie theater, the airport, the florist, the bank, the mall, I see posters proclaiming that early detection is the best protection and mammograms save lives. But she asks, how many lives exactly are being saved? Under what circumstances are they? And at what cost? That is what we're talking about today. Joining me is Peggy Orenstein. She's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She is also author of several books, including Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of a New Girly Girl Culture, and Waiting for Daisy. And she joins me in studio. Hi, Peggy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey. So you've come to write about breast cancer from your own very personal experience with the disease. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the first time you've done so. So why don't we go back kind of to 1996? Mm-hmm. You were 35 years old.
Right.
What did you do when you find out about your cancer?
Okay, I just have to say, 1996, this is a big fact-checking argument, because I got the mammogram in 1996 because it was December, but I found out I had cancer in 1997.
In January?
So, in January. It's one of those like things that you get really arguey about with the fact-checker, and I think that they made the wrong call on that. Mm-hmm. But so I found out that I was 35 years old, and I was sent to have a mammogram by my doctor at the time. At that time, they were doing sort of baseline mammograms at 35, and I thought, okay, my health insurance deductible is paid up. You know, what the heck? And they found a small spoke-like pattern that turned out to be cancer, invasive cancer. And I had a lumpectomy and radiation, and then I sort of went on my merry way. And I believe, like I think many people believe when their cancer's found on a mammogram, that the mammogram saved my life. And I went on believing that for quite some time. But over the course of years, a combination of the changes in understanding of what cancer is, the changes in understanding of the limits and the harms of mammography, and then finally my own recurrence last summer really made me change my mind and just want to take a hard look at what the benefits of mammography are and what its harms and limits are as well.
So you really dug into this after the recurrence.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I had been thinking about doing a story like this for several years, but it's hard. It's hard on a couple of levels. One is just a personal level that when I write, I kind of live, think, breathe, dream about the subject. And I just emotionally and psychologically, it was difficult for me to reimmerse myself in cancer. I kept saying to my editor, I want to do the story. And she'd say, okay. And then I wouldn't do it. And so then by the time I finally had the recurrence and I was just laying there on my back anyway for several months with nothing else to do except for live, think, dream, breathe cancer, it was a lot easier psychologically to handle it. But meanwhile, the research was just building. So I could have written it several years ago, but I'm actually glad I didn't, because I think the research is becoming more clear and our understanding of cancer is becoming more clear with each passing year.
Right. So soon after your successful early detection lumpectomy, there was controversy with the National Institutes of Health, who, quote, declined to recommend universal screening for women in their 40s because they say evidence didn't show it significantly decreased breast cancer deaths in that age group. And you were not happy.
No,
why? At the time. So this was, again, back I was 35 years old. Yeah. I was furious because I thought, you know, it was my life that they were talking about. It was my life that had been, I thought, saved by the mammogram. And one of the things that really doesn't get discussed in the kind of distortion of the pink ribbon culture is the harms of mammography and its limits. And I think what tended to get out there, and later again in 2009 when the independent task force put out recommendations on mammography, the thing that we tend to hear is, you know, unnecessary biopsies, a little anxiety, that kind of thing. And that's, you know, that's an issue. But most women would say, I'll take that if it's going to, you know, help somebody else.
Can you break that down? Can you just explain that?
Starting with what? With which part?
Just with the bad side to mammography. Okay. So, why are mammograms bad, in your view?
So the question with mammography is not, well, it is whether or not to do it, but the question is the age to start and the interval at which to do it and when to stop to maximize its benefits, its potential to do us good, and to minimize its risks. The benefits are the potential to catch a cancer that would otherwise, by the time it became clinically apparent, be difficult to treat, be more difficult to treat, be potentially lethal. And of the 138,000 breast cancers that are diagnosed through screening, between 3 and 13%, the test has made a difference for that group. So between 3,000 and 13,000 of those 138,000 cancer diagnoses are positively affected by the mammogram. The rest would be equally treatable or equally not treatable were they to become clinically apparent. So those are the benefits. And that is a benefit. If you're in that 3,000 to 13,000 Goldilocks group,
it's a lifesaver.
Good for you. Mm-hmm. You know, great. The rest of the people, whatever. So the downsides are that for every 2,000 women screened over the course of 10 years in their 50s and 60s, one will be have her death averted by a mammogram, and 10 will be overdiagnosed, which includes being told that they have an invasive cancer that would excuse me, I'm sorry, I have mm-hmm. a little asthma, would otherwise be including being told that they have cancer, going through cancer treatment, going through surgery, going through radiation, possibly having a mastectomy, possibly having chemotherapy.
When they had nothing in the first place?
When they had a cancer that would not harm them in their lifetime, that would not metastasize. So the thing with breast cancer that you have to realize is that breast cancer in your breast is not what kills you. Breast cancer, when it spreads to other organs or the bones, metastasizes, that's called. That's what kills you. So you can have a breast cancer that is so slow growing and indolent that it will never metastasize in your lifetime. It would never grow to become something that you would feel, or if it did, it still wouldn't metastasize. Meanwhile, you can also have a teeny weeny, itty bitty, tiny, tiny cancer that has already metastasized because it's very aggressive. And that's because our understanding of cancer now, of breast cancer, is that it's a family of diseases. It's not one single thing called breast cancer, but there's a range of kinds of breast cancer that can go from really the, you know, a fairly non-aggressive, though still life-threatening, but very slow moving kind of thing to something that is just whipping through your body.
Mm. And so 17 years after your first diagnosis, as you said, you know, the research changed, the science has changed, specifically studies on mammography and mm-hmm. other early detection methods and how useful they really are. So, you know, like, where are we now with breast cancer research compared to 1996? When you were first diagnosed?
Which aspect of it?
What is the latest?
What we know now about what breast cancer is has really changed. Well, I guess it's been confirmed more than changed.
Right.
But knowing that breast cancer is a lot of different diseases is different. We still don't know how to cure breast cancer. If you have metastatic disease, it is still considered incurable. We still can't prevent breast cancer from happening.
But there are risk factors you can try to minimize.
Yes, you can do some things to minimize risk to a degree,
right.
But there's nothing that you can do that can. I mean, you know, here, I mean, I obviously, look, I'm I'm thin. I exercise. I eat organic broccoli.
You got it.
Twice. You know, so and I don't have any known genetic issue or anything.
It wasn't in your family.
No. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe I got hit by a bad sunspot one day. I don't, you know, you don't really know why it happens. But so there's a lot that hasn't happened. There's also a lot that has. You know, Herceptin was a huge game changer for a lot of women, not for everybody. But that's a drug that certain cancers respond to and can make a difference for a lot of women. There's certain drugs that have been developed that are helping women. There's a lot of work being done to reduce toxicity. That's really important, so that when we are being treated, we're being treated in the most effective way with the fewest side effects and the least long-term harms and toxicity. That's a major issue for all cancer patients, I'm sure you know. So there has been some change, and there's, you know, we still have a long way to go.
So when you had your recurrence, What was kind of your initial reaction? And you had been following all the research that, mm-hmm. that was going on prior to that. So what was your initial reaction? What did you want to do?
My initial reaction, I don't think I can say on the radio. I also want to say, though, a minute about things that have changed, is that the rates, the death rates have dropped from breast cancer about 25% since 1990. And that's great, too. So it's still a lot of women. We're still 40,000 women are dying, 109 a day. But in 1990, it was 118 a day. So that is some progress as well.
But you don't think that is because of mammograms or early detection?
Some of it may be. That's a really controversial thing. So it conservatively, half of that may be due to screening. And again, that's a reason to screen at, you know, from your 50s and your 60s. Much of that is due to treatment, because the early studies in mammography that came out in the 70s, 60s and 70s were conducted before chemotherapy, before Herceptin, before tamoxifen, before aromatase, before all these things. So those things have offset a lot of the benefits of screening, which is a good thing. You know, that's a good thing. But that's that. In terms of my own reaction to my cancer, you know, I mean,
what did it make you want to do? Terms of, you know, you've read all this research. Had you already formed your opinion about that mammogram you took in 1996, and the treatment you'd gotten? And
well, my treatment options were my actual treatment options were very limited. I couldn't have another lumpectomy and radiation, because you can't have radiation to the same body part twice. So this time I had a mastectomy, and I chose to do reconstructive surgery with that. And I'm on a drug called tamoxifen that I'll take for the next 5 years that reduces my chances of metastasis quite a bit.
And you were debating.
I debated about whether or not to have my other breast removed. And that is a really important issue because it's become a more common kind of thing for women to do. The rates of women who have ductal carcinoma in situ, which I think we'll probably get to, which is a kind of precancerous condition, really, inside the ducts, not necessarily invasive cancer, but can predict invasive cancer. The rates of women who are choosing to have both breasts removed who have that has gone up 188% since 1996, and the rates of women with a low-grade invasive cancer like mine who are choosing to have the other breast removed have gone up 150%. And it appears that those decisions are not being based on actual medical understanding that your risk, that two things. One is that your real danger is cancer in the rest of your body, not in your breast. And also that your risk of getting cancer in your other breast over 10 years is probably about 30% for most of those women. I mean, I'm sorry. I take that back. That was wrong.
They think
it's 30%. It's actually 5%. I want to make sure I'm clear about that. Mm-hmm. So there's a distorted sense of the risk factor of
breast cancer.
If I keep
my other breast, it will get cancer.
That's the belief. And that is in part due to an exaggerated sense of risk. And that, I think, is part of the problem with a culture where you see breast cancer everywhere, and where the risks of breast cancer and the fear of breast cancer have been exaggerated to the point of distorting our medical decision making.
So why do you think the fear has been exaggerated, and who, and why, and who's doing it, and what do they get out of it?
Let's get to that in a minute. I just want to say one more thing about the bilateral mastectomy issue. You know, for me, when I thought about it, I certainly thought about it and wrestled with it, because it's scary. It's scary to be told you have breast cancer, and you just think, get the whole thing gone. I just want it gone, right? But, you know, especially taking the drugs that I'm taking now that many breast cancer patients are on, it lowers my risk to that of an average woman of getting cancer in the other breast. And I really, and my doctor said, you know, would you tell an average woman to cut her breasts off? Mm. And I thought about that, and I thought, I mean, my God, we're sitting here in San Francisco. We're sitting here on a fault line. You know, we live with all kinds. I don't put sunscreen on every day. I eat junk food once in a while. I forget to take my calcium. We have all kinds of risks in our life that we have to weigh and we have to make decisions on. And in some ways, I don't ever want to indicate that I think breast cancer is, you know, I don't want to trivialize it. I don't want to in any way say that it's not incredibly important. You know, hundreds of thousands of women are diagnosed a year. 40,000 women die. Many of us are living with fear and threat. It's an important disease to address. And at the same time, we want to use that energy. So it's fear. The fear of cancer is understandable, but it can be manipulated and sold and exaggerated. And that's the part that bothers me.
That's Peggy Orenstein. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call, and today we're talking about breast cancer. We'd like to know if you have had an experience with breast cancer, or someone in your family that you took care of, that you know of, your mom, your sister, your wife, your daughter, and also about the whole breast cancer awareness campaigns that have been going on throughout the years, the cult of pink, as they call it. So if you have any experiences you'd like to share or a question you'd like to ask Peggy, you can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Peggy, pink. It's funny, your first book that we had you on for on Your Call years ago was about, you know, you didn't want your daughter was overwhelmed with princess culture and pink.
I think
and you
related.
Didn't like it.
I
think so. And
I think pink
again,
is a perfectly
pink.
Fine color. I don't mean to be, you know, but yeah, I seem to be the anti-pink person.
You're the anti-pink.
I don't know.
All right. So
there are worse things to be.
So the culture.
Yeah,
let's really get
pink
into
ribbon culture.
Not just pink ribbon culture, but this idea that, okay, we have to take it seriously. It is happening. Breast cancer is a very serious matter. But then you're saying that it's being overdone and it's being exaggerated.
Well,
can
and
we
it's
get
not
back
being
to...
it's not being channeled. I mean, it's awareness in service of obliviousness to a degree, because awareness has been reduced to just visibility, to just, you know, buying the yogurt container or just seeing. And it becomes this sort of meaningless thing where you have all these. I mean, and I hope that we can get to, you know, what it's doing to younger women and these sorts of, you know, distorted messages. We're getting messages that are just wrong under the guise of pink. We're allowing corporations to pinkwash in which they.
What does that mean?
So pinkwashing is like, well, let's use an example. Let's use Chevron as an example. So on the front page of many of the California Komen affiliates, there is a
and that is Komen is
Susan G. Komen for now they're not for the cure anymore. They're Susan G. Komen Foundation now, and they're the biggest breast cancer charity in the country. And they pull in now I'm going to get the figure a little wrong, but it's over $400 million a year through their races, their corporate partnerships. And I think that people who donate to Komen believe that that money is going to research, when in fact the percentage that's allocated to research has dropped from 29% in 2008 to 16%. Last year, 16% of what they bring in goes to research.
Where does the rest of the money go?
A lot of it goes to awareness. to awareness education, to promoting mammography, to promoting early detection, and really distorting and overpromising early detection. At Dartmouth, Steve Wallachin called them out recently for their ad last October during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, in which they distorted the figures of the impact of mammography on women's health. They weren't wrong, but they were quoted in a way that they knew was giving the wrong impression. And they subsequently, actually right after I asked them about it in January when I was doing this piece, they pulled it off their website. But the pinkwashing is
And we must say that we invited the Susan G. Komen Foundation to be on the show, and they declined to be on the program.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So on the California affiliate pages, they have they commend Chevron right on the homepage for being a good neighbor for their contributions to Komen. Meanwhile, I don't know if any of your listeners were hanging out in West Berkeley last year and saw the gigantic plume of smoke coming out of Richmond.
Or in Richmond.
Yeah, or in Richmond. I was in West Berkeley then, so that's why I just went, oh, my God, what's that? And that ended up being a massive refinery fire that got that Cal OSHA ended up fining Chevron, you know, the largest fine for willful safety violations ever in the state of California. Allowing them to go on your site and say that they're good neighbors for giving to breast cancer when they are endangering public health in another realm is pinkwashing. I think that's the best example I can give you.
Okay, so that's a really big example. Mm-hmm. What are some small, tiny examples that we may notice in our daily lives?
Well, you know, anytime I think that a company is allowed to drape itself in pink when it's potentially harming health, women's health, men's health, children's health in other realms, whether that's by KFC having pink buckets of chicken and, you know, putting out.
Maybe it's the grilled chicken.
Maybe it's the grilled chicken. No, it's not the grilled chicken.
Okay.
or letting dangers to public health, or, you know, you could even say, depending on how they're treating women in their companies, or NFL putting on pink cleats when they're having all kinds of controversy about domestic violence and how the league treats its players when they have been convicted of or accused of domestic violence, that would be pinkwashing. So it's an easy way for companies and politicians to signal that they care about women without necessarily doing anything that is useful, and while continuing practices that may be harming women or men or children.
Whereas people might be saying, you know, when I buy that pink ribbon, I feel good.
Yes.
I have done something. I feel I'm helping.
And that's the other issue, is that it creates a kind of sense of, I think that people want that. And I understand that we want to do something, we should do something, but you don't want to create a sense of complacency about it, so that this money that you're putting out there, your dollar, 1 cent of that dollar is going to, you know, whatever the Pink Foundation is, 16% of that 1 cent is going to research. You don't know what that research is. So there's this distancing, not only from what's really going on, but from the reality of the disease and what needs to happen now. Now that we are all aware, is to step back and to say, okay, where do we need, with our goodwill, with our effort, with our concern, with our love, with our grief, with our money, where do we need to put that to bear? What pressure do we need to exert?
And you feel
where?
Like there's one bucket now, and all this money is being put into this
in
one bucket.
In order to make the needle move. What are the things that, you know, we need to be putting more money into metastatic research. We need to be putting more money into allocating differently, not necessarily more money, into environmental stuff, perhaps. Maybe we need to be looking at this issue of ductal carcinoma in situ and overdiagnosis. I mean, there's a number of things that need to happen that aren't, because of the emphasis on awareness and mammography.
All right. We'll talk about that more. With me is Peggy Orenstein. I'm Hanat Bhabha, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We'll be right back after this break.
Your Call here on KALW San Francisco. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send a question or comment to the email inbox. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hannah Ababa sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, Rose Aguilar will host a debate about geoengineering, manipulating the environment. Is it our last hope for a warming planet, or is it a false solution? Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We'll talk with reporter Jeremy Shahill about his recent film, Dirty Wars. But today, what's the best way to fight breast cancer? I'm talking to Peggy Orenstein about her recent New York Times Magazine article, Our Feel-Good War on Breast Cancer. Orenstein herself has battled the disease, and she's now questioning the promotion of early detection, the singular promotion of early detection, and the whole cult of pink. And she asks, has raising awareness become more important than actually saving lives? And we want to know, how has breast cancer affected you, your family, maybe someone you know, your friend, and the awareness campaigns, kind of the pink washing that Peggy was talking about before the break. What do you think about all of that? And how has the whole breast cancer awareness campaign affected you? Join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we have a number of callers, but let's get back to that, to the pink washing. I think because so many people can actually relate to that. And you know, full disclosure, I myself had a bout or two actually with cancer, not breast cancer, but lymphoma. So our organization is the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. And, you know, our color is purple. And, you know, I went on the walks and everything. But I feel like it is not as overwhelming as the pink, you know, of the breast cancer campaigns.
Because who knew? I wouldn't have been able to tell you that your color was purple.
You didn't know the color, right?
No,
leukemia, lymphoma, purple,
no,
purple ribbons.
But it's interesting. You know,
but
the
what is that difference? Why the breast
Why
cancer?
Breast cancer? Well, I think it's an intertwining series of things. One is that it affects so many women, and it affects a lot of young, you know, a lot of women in their 40s and 50s, which I now think of as young women.
we are.
Yeah. I think that it's partly the success of the women's health movement from the 70s that the women's health movement was organized, took on breast cancer as an issue, and that moved it forward. I think it's a disease that feels like it has, and I'm not saying this from my perspective, I'm saying this from a collective, a societal perspective, that it feels sort of innocent. You know, that it's your mother, your sister, your daughter. It's like apple pie. It's the breast. It's the symbolism of the breast. So I think there's a lot of things that come together. But I wouldn't, you know, I think it, one of the unfortunate things is that diseases have come to be pitted against one another. And you know, I don't think that's a good thing for any of us. And the research and work that's done in one form of cancer can often affect other forms of cancer. So work in breast cancer also affects ovarian cancer. This whole issue of the different kinds of breast cancer, there was another article that was on the front page of the New York Times a couple of days ago saying that cancer is not being seen as site-specific, but being talked about in terms of its biology. Because, for instance, there's a form of breast cancer that's very aggressive that's much more like ovarian cancer than other breast cancers. There may be a form of pancreatic cancer that they find someday that's more like lymphoma. You know, I mean, I'm just throwing that out. But so the research that's being done on different cancers does affect all of us.
You know, you were writing.
It can affect all
it
of us.
Can.
Yeah.
So you were writing against this widespread belief, you know, in mammography and early detection and kind of also these large foundations like Susan G. Komen. What kind of reactions have you gotten from your article so far? Because, you know, some people might think, you know, just like I said, I bought the ribbon. I did the right thing. My mom had breast cancer. I walked for her. So They're very emotionally invested.
Yeah, as they should be.
So,
as they should be. And they should then feel, you know, that they want that love and caring and grief and energy and physical activity and fundraising to mean something. Mm. But I'll tell you what, I have been overwhelmed by response to this article. And it has been, I would say, 99.999% incredibly supportive and positive and relieved. And I was kind of shocked by that. I really didn't expect it. And I mean, all the way along the spectrum, one thing that's been really interesting to me is I've gotten a lot of feedback from really high level researchers and heads of hospitals and oncologists and such in you know, top tier institutions around the world. And that makes me, who are saying, thank you for saying this in a way that is comprehensible to the average patient, which I think I could do because I'm the average patient. I'm an English major. You know, if I can understand it, you can understand it, you know, but often they can't make
that. The article is not wonky at all.
No, because I can't be wonky because I can't understand it if it's wonky. And so all those wonky people, it's really important. You know, if I can get them to tell me, you know, to break it down, I have to go, look, I'm really embarrassed, but I don't understand what you're talking about. Can you break it down? Can you break it down as a reporter to make it accessible? And somehow they knew all this, and it has not been filtering down to the level of physicians who treat patients or to the public itself. So there was a lot of gratitude for explaining this in a way that can allow the public to make fully informed decisions.
All right. All right. So we have a number of callers waiting on the line. Let's go to our first caller. Hello. You're on your call.
Oh, is that me?
Yes, that's you. Oh, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a 74-year-old Jewish woman, and I have been scared of getting breast cancer all my life, along with all my other 70-year-old women. And my year is kind of gone. It goes from mammogram to mammogram. That's how I, you know, get through the year. And my feeling is that all these walks and these pink ribbons and everything is, I hate them. I think that the pharmaceutical companies don't want to find a cure for cancer. I don't think they want to do anything about prevention, which is what I think is the most important thing we can do, because there's no money in it. There's so much money in women having breast cancer and all this hype about walking and pink ribbons and everything. It just makes me sick. And
but you still take your mammogram every year?
Absolutely. I can't imagine not having a mammogram every year. I had, when I was 34, I had what was called an introductal papilloma. And I'm always worried that that's, you know, a precursor for possibly getting breast cancer. I've had three other cancers in my life. I've had ovarian, skin, and bladder cancer, which I'm still dealing with.
So you're a high risk person. So when we're talking about high risk women, that's a totally different conversation than screening with an average risk woman.
Well, but you know, it's interesting. I read an article in the Chronicle, maybe a year ago or something about, or maybe it wasn't the Chronicle, but anyways, about some kind of a test to see if you've had a couple cancers, if you know, you could be in this group that could get other cancer. Anyways, I had the test and it was negative, so that was good. But
well, it's interesting that you have a particular.
Well, thank you for the call, Peggy. You want to take that on?
Yeah, it's interesting that you have a particular fear of breast cancer when you've survived what, you know, some might consider more potentially lethal cancers like ovarian cancer. But you know, I think one of the issues with pink that was important to me to discuss was how it created a climate of fear and the impact of that climate of fear. And one of the things that I was looking at a lot was this kind of new demographic of pink ribbon culture, which is young women and teenage girls, and the increasing marketing to them of the fear of breast cancer and of the need to do something proactive. Self-exam is what they talk about, which is something that has been shown to, you're taking your fingers and
I'm taking my three fingers.
You know, the thing is that studies have shown, trials have shown that self-exam does not detect cancer at an earlier stage. It does not detect more cancer, and it does not change the mortality rate. So self-exam really has not been shown to have any particular impact. So if you don't do it, don't feel bad about it. And the good news about it is that women find their cancer. Generally, women find their own cancer.
Right, you
did.
I
did the second time. Yeah. The way that they find it is the way that I did. I'm doing right now. I'm rubbing my thumb along my scar because it's reflexive. But, mm-hmm. I sort of went, oh, I was changing my clothes, talking to my husband, watching TV, listening to see if my daughter was asleep yet, doing 40,000 of the things that one does every day, and just happened to rub across that spot and go, uh-oh. And that's how it usually gets found. But marketing to these young girls, I worry, is especially as we're seeing these this rise of fear, this rise of women who are having bilateral mastectomies, et cetera, what teaching girls before they've even discovered their breasts as erotic organs, mm-hmm. before they've learned to feel joy and love and potentially nurture others, to think of them as precancerous organs, that concerns me a lot. And they don't need to. They do not need to be doing that.
Let's go through our callers, and the number of you are waiting on the line. Thank you for waiting. Let's go to Linda in San Mateo. Hi, Linda. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. I just want to commend your guests for speaking out like this. I read the article on in the Times on Sunday, and I was so excited that you were going to bring me on the air, because this is one of my things that I'm in my early 70s, and I've only had one mammogram in my whole life. I just knew intuitively that early on, number one, it wasn't good for us because of the amount of radiation. I mean, this is how I felt, my own opinion. I just felt that the risk of too much radiation outweighed the breast cancer that they might possibly find. The other thing is, I still feel like the reading of the mammogram is only as good as the person. Is only as good as the person that reads it.
Hmm. That's true. That's absolutely
true. All
right. True.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah. Thank you so much, Peggy.
We're lucky in the Bay Area to have really outstanding radiologists. We live in an area that has really top-notch medical professionals. Gilbert Welch at Dartmouth says that deciding whether to have a mammogram or not is really a close call. The most likely thing that's going to happen if you have a mammogram is nothing, right? You're going to go home and it's going to be fine. Nothing's going to happen. The chances that it will make a difference for you, that it will avert death from breast cancer, it changes the chances for a woman in her 50s by 0.07 percentage points. So it might make a difference, but most likely nothing's going to happen either way. So to make a decision not to have mammograms is not a crazy decision. It's not an unreasonable decision. If you are going to have mammograms, that's also a very reasonable decision. But then what you need to really look at is when to start and what the interval is. And one of the things that was really interesting was that in 2009, this independent congressionally appointed task force that included some doctors from the Bay Area like Laura Esserman came out and said there's no the evidence that mammography averts death for women under 40 versus the harms that they incur is not enough to warrant recommending it, similar to women over 74. In that 50 to 74 period, every other year, you get the same impact as doing it every year, and that's what we should be doing. And that, unfortunately, came out right at the top at the height of the controversy over the healthcare debate, and it was seized upon largely by Republican leadership as a sign that healthcare was going to be rationed, and Obama was against women and mothers and your wife and your child, and the Obama administration immediately backpedaled because nobody wants to be seen as being anti-woman, and they said our policies have not changed, and that shut the discussion right down. And rather than becoming a science-based, evidence-based discussion of what was best for women's health, it became completely politicized, and it's gone, and it was lost. And that's one of the things I wanted to bring.
It's not the first issue of women's health to be politicized.
No, it's not. And it's important to go back to those recommendations, which still are valid, about when we start having them, when we stop having mammograms, and what the best interval in terms of the best benefit, the greatest benefit for the least harm.
Well, one of the people you quote in the article is Dr. Gilbert Welsh. He is a general internist at the White River Junction VA and a professor of medicine at Dartmouth. And much of his work has focused on overdiagnosis in cancer screening. He wrote the book, Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not. And Here's Why. And Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. And Dr. Welch is on the phone with us. Hi, Dr. Welch, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Hi, thanks for being here. So you've been on, hearing this conversation. What,
yes.
What do you want to say about kind of the overdiagnosis of cancer and when people should or should not be tested for cancer? It's hard to tell for someone who's in that situation.
Yeah, it's a close call, as Peggy mentioned. And I'd like to just hit on three points that have been articulated, but let's just make sure your listeners are clear. First, people like me, we all agree breast cancer is an important disease. It's arguably the cancer that's most relevant for a non-smoking woman. The second point is there's really been good news in breast cancer. Breast cancer mortality has fallen about 30%. The death rate from breast cancer has fallen about 30% in the last two decades. And the third thing I want to make sure is when we're raising question about screening mammograms, we're not saying anything about the value of mammography as a way to evaluate a breast lump that a woman has found. That's a diagnostic mammogram, and I think it's important that all your listeners understand if they feel a breast lump, all of us agree that getting a diagnostic mammogram is a good thing to do. The question is about screening mammograms, and that's where I think a real choice comes in. And Peggy mentioned some of the harms of screening mammograms, and one of the things that you've been talking about is this whole exaggerated risk that has occurred in the whole general population about breast cancer, and part of that is because of screening, because the very first step to encourage a population to be screened is to get people to have worry about the disease. Otherwise, they won't come in to be screened. So that's one of the downsides that I would see about screening mammography is it has contributed, or really its promotion has contributed to this overall sense, exaggerated sense of risk. The other harm that people are familiar with is the false positives and the extra biopsies, but the thing they're probably less familiar with is this idea of overdiagnosis. And it turns out, as Peggy mentioned, you know, breast cancer, and in fact, most cancers aren't just one thing. There's a whole variety of cancers within the same organ. And that's very true of breast cancer. And the breast is a high turnover organ. And it now is not really much anyone debates this anymore, that some of the things that look like cancer under a microscope may go away on their own. And that's kind of a new idea, may regress. And others, of course, will go ahead and progress and cause a lot of problems. The problem with mammography is it doesn't sort these out. We're not really able to sort these out yet. It leads us to find a whole lot more cancers, and that means we're treating some women for something that's called cancer that will actually never matter to her. And that's what makes it a trade-off.
All right.
The benefit is of mammography is probably there. It's probably pretty small. The harms are also there, and that's what makes it a very difficult and a decision that different women looking at the same data could reasonably arrive at different conclusions about.
That's Dr. Gilbert Welch. He's a cancer researcher in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're going to go through some calls as well today. This has resonated with many of you. Let's go to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Yeah, you sort of answered some of my question with partly like, well, then who should get a mammography? And I guess you also said that reading it was part of the issue and that the radiologists were good in this area. So I guess that kind of leads to my other question is how do we really get information that we can rely on and that is accurate if it's, and where do we get it? You said earlier that 30% of the, well, the statistics were inaccurate around who would, I forget what it was, but earlier you had, and didn't get back to it, but I'm trying to figure out how do we get accurate information and how do we determine whether the treatments and the medical personnel we're working with are going to give us the best treatment.
All right. Gosh, thank you, Lisa.
That is such a big question. You know, I mean, I think it's really hard to get accurate information. My aunt just emailed me, you know, saying, asking me whether she should get a mammogram. She's 82 years old, you know, what this means and why her doctors. And it, you know, you have to be authentically aware, I guess. You have to really look at the research yourself, and you have to make sure that you ask questions. You have to, I think for any individual woman, you need to understand your own risk factors. You need to also ask the questions. If your doctor is recommending a mammogram for you and you are outside the age that it is most beneficial for, and you're 50, if you're under 50 or over 74, you want to know why. You want to know what they're, you know, expecting. You want to know what would you do if you found something? There's all kinds of questions to ask. So good information. I think Susan Love's book has really great information. That's one resource that I look at as a consumer, as a patient. Mm-hmm. Susan Love's breast book, I think it's still the most definitive for patients. Mm-hmm. About breast cancer. I think Breast Cancer Action offers really good information. National Breast Cancer Coalition offers really good information. Where else does Breast Cancer Fund has really good information?
Okay, good. All right, thank you. We'll have those. We'll try to get those up on our website as well for all our listeners to have access to. So let's go to Carrie in Newark. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for holding on the line.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to thank you, Ms. Ornstein, for writing the article. I read it a few days ago, and it was really something to read. I had a comment and a question. So the comment was that I myself have been really conflicted about the awareness campaign around breast cancer for a number of years. My sister died about a dozen years ago of breast cancer at the age of 41, a year and a day after her diagnosis. She had a mammogram a few months before she was diagnosed, and the mammogram showed nothing. She had inflammatory breast cancer, and so it's a particularly virulent strain of breast cancer, and it metastasized, and it was a pretty tough time. So what was ironic to see is that people who were trying to be supportive were actually a little bit complacent and in denial, because what they kept telling us was, oh, breast cancer survival rates are so great, you'll be just fine, when in fact, no, she wasn't going to be just fine. And so that was pretty painful. The question that I had was, what breast cancer charities or what cancer charities do you recommend as being the ones who most powerfully support research into prevention and into treatment of metastatic disease?
Okay, thank you, Carrie.
First of all, Carrie, I'm really, really sorry to hear about your sister. And inflammatory breast cancer is a kind of unusual form of breast cancer that often doesn't present with a primary tumor. So that is not so surprising that a mammogram didn't catch that. And it's also important to know that about 30% of early stage tumors will recur sometimes years afterwards, like mine did. Mine recurred, and I don't have metastatic disease. I want to be clear. I don't. I had a local recurrence. At least I don't think I do. 16 years later, that is not unusual. And part of the way that mammography skews the statistics is that it offers 5-year survival rates. But if you find a cancer earlier that you're going to die of, all you really found out was that, you know, three years earlier that you have that cancer. The charities that I would look in, I cannot recommend a specific charity, but I will tell you that I think the ones that I mentioned a moment ago, I think all of them do very good work. I think Breast Cancer Action does wonderful work. Breast Cancer Fund does wonderful work. Those are both local.
Ones are better than the...
Not necessarily. National Breast Cancer Coalition. Okay. Is excellent. Susan Love's research I forget exactly what it's called, Susan Love, whatever it is, does very good work. And what I would do is look at those and see what moves you. And also just be very careful when you donate to charity in general. You know, look at Charity Navigator, look at GuideStar, see what the what goes to programs, see what those programs are. Because, you know, if you looked at Charity Navigator for Komen, 82% of what they pull in goes to programs. But what are programs? You know, programs mean awareness about mammography. They don't necessarily mean research. So you have to sort of really get to know the charity, just like anything else. You know, it's a partnership, the charity that's right for you.
All right. We have a couple of emails that came in. Francis Taylor is a medical epidemiologist, and he says, I've always had problems with the pink slogan, searching for a cure. We need to be looking for prevention. Mm-hmm. Chuck sent in an email saying, on NPR last year, Florence Williams discussed the shocking amount of toxins in her breast milk. You know, is there more than just an anecdotal link between the amount of toxins in breast milk and the mammographies, the mammograms? So those are some of the emails that, that have come in. We might have time for one more caller. Yes, let us go to one last caller. Dr. Wittenberg in Berkeley, hi, you're on Your Call. Hello, Dr. Wittenberg.
It's an artifact that leads to the notion of early detection leading to cure. And the artifact comes from the artificial statement that if you live 5 years beyond whatever treatment is done, that you've been cured. And let me give you an example. If somebody has a man...
All right, we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Gilbert Welch from Massachusetts. And indeed, Peggy Orenstein, thank you so much for being with us in studio.
Oh, my
time
pleasure.
Time flies by, I know. Yeah. Thank you for joining us. Thank you on the lines if we haven't gotten to you. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Is geoengineering our last hope against global warming, or is it a false solution? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about geoengineering. While environmentalists say we need to keep reducing carbon emissions, some scientists are researching the potential of artificial interventions, like adding sulfur to the atmosphere. How bad would the climate have to get for us to use a strategy like this? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What do you think about climate manipulation? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.